On this week's episode, my special guest is Roshi Joan Halifax. She's written a brand new book, Standing at the Edge, Finding Freedom Where Fear and Courage Meet. Regarding this book, Arianna Huffington writes, in Standing at the Edge, Joan Halifax weaves together scientific research with her own powerful personal experiences as a social activist and humanitarian to show how we can transform our biggest challenges with compassion and wisdom. Standing at the Edge is essential reading for our time. Well, Roshi Joan Halifax, PhD, is a Buddhist teacher, Zen priest, anthropologist, and pioneer in the field of end-of-life care. She is founder, abbot, and head teacher at Upaya Institute and Zen Center in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and it's from the Institute that she's joining us today. Roshi Joan Halifax, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
Thank you. I'm grateful to be here.
I've read many of your books. I've certainly followed your work in death and dying with my hospice chaplain background. That's near and dear to my heart. I love this book, and I love the title, Standing at the Edge. Can you share how and where you got that idea?
You know, I have been working in this end-of-life care field for many decades, but also working with people who are engaged in human rights, organizations who are also educators and people in politics and people who are in business contexts. And I've had this experience of listening to people who are really endeavoring to serve others, whether it's in the medical system or, as I said, around human rights or education, where there have been certain kinds of sufferings associated with this deep sense of commitment to serve.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I learned so much being able to sit in interview with people and hearing about what their experience is as an educator. For example, taking care of kids in the inner city where there are there's a lot of economic struggle, where parents are absent, where the neighborhoods are dangerous, and the kids are basically traumatized.
Yeah.
Or working in a medical system where there's such high demands, including quotas that have to be met in terms of number of patients one sees. So, I feel very blessed to have also done a lot of work myself,
mm-hmm,
in conditions that have been really challenging in the end-of-life care field, in the prison system, and in human rights work.
Yes.
And so, you know, looking at my own experience and the experience of literally thousands of others, I realize that some of the really important qualities that we value in our service to others have a shadow side, and that people can fall into great suffering, whether you're a clinician or a parent or an educator, in terms of, you know, the deep intention to be of service to others, to alleviate suffering, but find oneself in the knot of suffering as well,
mm,
in our experience of serving.
Yes.
And I isolated five of these qualities, and they include altruism. And altruism, a world that has no altruism, is a world that we could not survive in. But also altruism can tip over the edge into what's called pathological altruism, where we are harmed ourselves or harm others in our endeavor to be of service. Empathy, another very important. A world without empathy is where we're dead to each other. But also, if our empathy is not regulated, we can experience empathic distress and secondary trauma.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Integrity is essential, but when integrity is not present, moral suffering arises, and that includes moral distress, moral injury, moral outrage, and moral apathy. Respect is essential. That's another edge state that I've isolated. And, of course, the opposite is disrespect. The shadow side is disrespect, where you have horizontal hostility and vertical violence. And then, finally, engagement, that, you know, we're wholeheartedly involved in our actions of compassion toward others, but we have to also be mindful of burnout.
Yeah, Yeah. I love the subtitle of this book, Finding Freedom, Where Fear and Courage Meet. It seems so appropriate today. In all of your travels, I believe it wasn't that long ago you were in Hawaii with Ram Dass and Frank Ostateski, as a matter of fact.
That's right.
But you travel the world. Have you seen in the last couple of years an increase in stress, an increase in fear wherever you go?
Well, one of the things that I said is that, you know, in a way, the meme of terror that got really activated around 9/11 now is instantiated, not just nationally, but also globally. And also how our attention has been co-opted by the corporate world through our digital devices. And that is putting a tremendous stress on us because our attention is constantly being attracted by these wonderful technologies that have been developed, but where we've actually disinhabited our world of relationship, direct relationship. And so I think there are many factors, economic, political, environmental, that compose a system of complexity that's giving rise to, you know, more and more stress, including the degradation of our environment. And there are more and more needs that have to be met because people are experiencing psychological and physical states that are a result of the intertwining of economic, environmental, social, cultural features that are part of our life today.
Yeah.
Including this, you know, unbearable demand of a huge population that is streaming out of areas of conflict and also areas affected by climate change.
Early in the book, you share.
So we have a lot of work to do, but we also have to create the conditions where we're not only resilient, but where we have the means to actually flourish in this work of addressing suffering.
Early in the book, you share an idea called positive disintegration. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you could share, first of all, what that means and also why is that so important?
So the notion of positive disintegration, which, by the way, is not just in terms of 20th century psychology, where Dabrowski and others, Julian Silverman, my ex-husband Stanislav Grof, and you know myself and others, where we saw the value of entropy falling apart. But you know that is a vision that is carried by indigenous cultures in rites of passage, or by the role of the shaman in a culture who goes through a psychomental crisis. And what we know from psychology is that stress can be distress, or it can be eustress. In other words, distress is where there's entropy that leads to complete dissolution. Or eustress is stress that actually enhances our well-being. And rites of passage are contexts where stress happens that is actually eustress, or even falling over the edge, as I describe in my book. One builds character by actually making one's way out of the abyss up that steep cliff to the high edge of virtue. Where you're able to see the whole landscape, not just the positive part of the landscape. So in terms of the development of one's character, we don't have to look for problems. Problems will be given to us throughout our lifespan. The Buddha had it right up until the day he died, in terms of Mara, the devil, if you will, showing up, which is really a way to talk about the devilment of our own mind. And, you know, it is really important for us to understand that catastrophe has within it the great possibility of our opportunity. And that's one of the premises in this book.
It's
not just a description of the shadow side, but it's also the acknowledgement that, you know, we all go over the edge. And we have this just really important opportunity that we can actualize in working with compassion to transform these great difficulties into benefits, not just burdens.
Speaking of shadow, you shared just a few minutes ago an overview of the edge states that you lay out in this book, the first one being altruism, and you acknowledge the profound strengths associated with that. Most of my listeners would say, well, yeah, there's nothing wrong with altruism, and yet you write it also has a shadow.
Absolutely. Altruism has a big shadow, and it's been Barb Oakley and others have talked about it in terms of pathological altruism, and that's when, you know, we harm ourselves by, you know, in the course of serving others, for example, you know, we burn out. We become emotionally upregulated and experience emotional distress and empathic or personal distress, that we actually sometimes harm the people we're trying to serve because we disempower them. Through how we're serving.
Mm-hmm.
We infantilize them. We make them dependent on us. Or the institutions, like a whole nation, could be disempowered through service. Or, you know, the UN goes into Haiti or the Red Cross, and gosh, what happens? You've got cholera on one side and, you know, no visible housing construction on another. So the faith in institutions of service gets actually broken. So pathological altruism has many different expressions.
Yeah, I've seen that. Having made numerous trips to Haiti, I've seen that played out all too often in the country of Haiti. And, you know, it's frustrating to be able to witness that. What about empathy, though? In the book, you make a point of distinguishing between empathy and compassion. And that's a nice distinction to make.
Right. So empathy is when we're in resonance with another.
Mm.
And, you know, that could be with our patient, our parent. It could be with our pet. It could be with a whole nation, for example. And is that where we're in this kind of either physical resonance, or it could include emotional resonance, or it could include cognitive resonance, where in terms of perspective taking, you know, where we can see how people presumably see the world. And that kind of identification process, which is based on resonance, direct experience, is really important. Although we can't validate what we are experiencing in terms of what another experiences is actually true. But when one is over-identified and doesn't make a distinction between self and other, then personal distress can arise. And this is called, you know, empathic arousal,
yes.
Empathic over-arousal, and empathic distress. And people really suffer. You know, I have so many clinicians who come into my world who found themselves over-identifying with their patients to the point where they become disabled, unable to really serve.
Yeah.
So learning how to actually regulate empathy, but empathy is essential. But at the same time, compassion, if you're empathic, doesn't necessarily mean you want to end the suffering. You're simply in resonance with it. Some psychologists conflate compassion and empathy, but a whole other group of social psychologists make a clear distinction. And compassion involves a number of factors, you know, including the deep concern for the well-being of another or others and the intention to do something that will actually alleviate that suffering.
You've shared that a good example of cognitive empathy or perspective taking or mind reading gone awry is the Third Reich, where people identified with Hitler.
Exactly. And every cult in the world has this problem. That's why they're cults. It's when we actually lose our moral compass because we are in such resonance with a charismatic leader that we lose our moral grounding, our moral compass. Third Reich is a good example, but, you know, any religious cult is an example of this as well.
So integrity is one of the edge states you've identified. What could be the downside or shadow side to integrity?
Well, I put all this under the rubric of moral suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the kind of suffering that arises when we directly incur, produce, or witness the unconscionable acts of others or ourselves. So moral distress is the first category I talk about, and this is when we see a way through a situation where there's suffering, but we actually can't implement it. We don't see that the solution is that we see is going to be viabilized. And that's something that actually a lot of people in medicine, but also education, come up against, the sense of moral distress.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next category, Richard, that I talk about is moral injury, and that is when we have participated directly or witnessed directly acts that that trespass our moral principles. So, for example, moral injury is rampant in the military, and so many of the vets who leave the military are actually suffering from moral injury. This is where they have a deep sense of shame and also self-blame in relation to the actions that they've engaged in that has caused or have caused suffering to others or the environment.
Well, and what about the role of moral outrage in our society?
Moral outrage is in a way the mirror of a moral injury. It's when shaming and blaming is outwardly directed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an admixture of anger and disgust. And the disgust thing is really important because our threat to our integrity, to our survival, is very deep in our brain system.
Yeah.
And so moral outrage and polarization is also rampant. You see it in the political world that our politicians, in terms of social media, are using using moral outrage in a certain way to viralize or breed moral outrage in others and polarize our nation.
Absolutely, absolutely. And yet also moral outrage probably is an example borne out in the last couple of years with the Me Too movement.
Well, and it's important. I mean, His Holiness the Dalai Lama said recently at a small conference that, you know, and I agree with this, having episodic moral outrage, that is more or reactive moral outrage, that is, you know, having the sense of our integrity or the world's well-being violated, and the sense of moral outrage instigates then actions that are wholesome in terms of ending that violation.
Yes.
So, you know, just like, you know, moral injury can be of benefit to an experiencer, in other words, feeling shame and then taking responsibility for causing harm to others.
When I think of the energy involved in moral outrage, I would think also that even that could be addictive.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there are friends of mine who are absolutely carried away by and feel wonderful in, you know, just thrashing everyone in sight. So, you know, again, it's to recognize, oh, I have a tendency to toward moral outrage. It feels really good. I love to have righteous anger driving my actions. And actually, righteous anger for just a flash can be useful.
Sure.
But as a chronic state, it's harmful.
Yes. Angry activists get burned out eventually, it seems.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a terrible state of mind to be in.
Yes, yes. Another edge state is respect.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, actually, the last one is important in this group of four,
yeah.
Richard, that
yes.
I just don't want to leave out, and that's moral apathy.
Oh, please.
And moral apathy is very important for us to look at because, you know, the privilege that so many of Western people enjoy, but not everyone, makes us, in a way, we're living in a bubble of privilege, and we don't actually see the suffering of others. Or how addiction plays. So privilege and addiction, two different things, but sometimes interconnected. How addiction covers up our sense, whether it's addiction to substances or lifestyle or sex or to the internet. It actually is putting a kind of anesthesia over our perception of suffering. So, you know, moral apathy can be blind to us, can be engendered by the social context in which we find ourselves, like, you know, we just took it for granted, you know, 50 years ago that women would be hit on in the workplace.
Yeah.
Not anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We just took it for granted that people of color would be discriminated against. Well, sorry, it's still going on, but we're much more aware of white privilege and how white privilege operates in our lives to create implicit racism.
We then come
to... have to bump ourselves out of our bubble, so to speak.
I love that phrase. Yeah, we do, don't we? And we can still become complacent. I know Richard Rohr has talked about that a lot. That's been his concern, especially in the United States. We kind of numb ourselves with TV and trivial topics all the time.
Exactly. I mean, well, you know, our use of our digital devices is a great way. We, you know, put our attention to something outward that is stupid.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So another edge state that you write about in your book is respect. And, you know, it's kind of hard to see a downside to respect, at least at first.
Well, we could say, but the shadow side, of course, of respect is disrespect. And mm-hmm. this comes in, you know, in relation to power. For example, 15 to 20% of nurses leave nursing because of bullying, being disrespected by their colleagues. By their peers. And we saw the same thing in the feminist movement in the 70s, that, you know, there was a lot of abrupt, abrasive, and unkind behavior between peers in the early feminist movement in this country. You see it also, so horizontal hostility happens, you know, in the religious context. You can see it between educators and so forth. Then there's vertical violence, and that is top down or bottom up. That is where, you know, someone who has more power or perceived power than, say, an employee, it's a boss employee situation, or doctor patient, or doctor nurse, where there are imbalances of power and where there's disrespect manifested in terms of how power is expressed. Also, bottom-up vertical violence, where we see people who are disenfranchised attacking those in power, or you see students attacking their teachers, or you see kids attacking their parents. So there's bottom-up vertical violence as well.
Wow.
Which is, you know, really the kind of norms of civility that... you know, our society has treasured are right now, you know, pretty challenged.
Yeah.
But I think that we don't recognize mostly, for example, just in relation to race or gender or age, those people who have less power or purchase in our social communities have been subjected to vertical violence, top-down vertical violence from forever. You know, that's why we have to go back to, you know, really be a values-driven society and to make sure these values are based in a vision of, that is civil and kind.
Yeah.
And on, you know, in a vision that's really about not harming.
Absolutely. In your book, Standing at the Edge, the fifth edge state is engagement, which can be another slippery slope for many of us.
It's true, because, you know, I was a little late for our meeting, only because, you know, we're in a wonderful process with our whole organization of really restructuring the leadership here and how our place operates. It's really, really exciting what's going on. And, you know, I said, well, I'm the kind of person who's all in. You know, it's kind of 24/7. But I've learned to pace myself. You know, I understand the value of naps. I understand the value of walking on the beach. I understand how important it is to be off social media for a month at a time, like when I'm in the Himalayas. That, you know, I have a healthy relationship with my work process. I feel enthusiasm for work, that it's meaningful work, and that the workplace itself is non-toxic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if it's toxic, or the demands of work are something that cannot be met, or the task itself is meaningless or promoting harm in the world, then burnout is the outcome.
Yes, burnout is rampant these days because I think people aren't taking care of themselves. And actually, you've kind of answered another question I had, and that is, how do you live with the edge states? And do you find yourself ever overwhelmed with all the traveling and all the situations you find yourself in? Like you said, death and dying, prison work. It can be trying. I've seen a lot of good people do harm to themselves.
Well, I think one thing is that, you know, I've had a practice for 50 years,
mm-hmm.
and that's benefiting me more and more, if you know what I'm saying. It's
yeah.
like I suffered from all of these edge states, which is probably why I wrote about them, because they were not only the experience of others, they were also my experience. But I learned the value of self-care and of regulating my situation so I could maintain some kind of strength and also sensitivity. So I, you know, the metaphor of strong back, soft front and is something I use in the book. And I use it with my students all the time. That learning when you're about to go over the edge to pull yourself back and to regulate and to have the exhale and to not have such disregard for your own situation that you don't, you know, I'll say, and I'm glad I'm so old, I can say it pretty legitimately now. Okay, I have to rest now. I won't be going to that funder's dinner. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. Uh-huh. Yeah, well, with age,
and I'm not afraid to have, you know, clear agreements and strong boundaries.
Yes.
Because I know I can only do so much.
Well, and we need those, don't we? Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely. Will you share a little bit? You're the founder, abbot, and head teacher of the Paya Institute and Zen Center there in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Share a little bit about what's going on there for our listeners.
It's an incredible place. It's a beautiful place physically, but it's a place that integrates social action and contemplation.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a very strong emphasis on a daily practice. There's also a very strong emphasis on training people who are chaplains and clinicians and people in human rights organizations and having the tools to really sustain themselves and to flourish in what they're doing in their service to others. So we're, you know, one of those places that values social engagement. And that social engagement happens in terms of direct process with others, service to others. So, you know, like some of our Sangha members sit with dying people in the cancer center here or in the hospital or in, you know, homes. We have a group that's been meeting since 1994 of people who are suffering from grief but also going through loss themselves.
Yes.
We have a street ministry where our community cooks for homeless people every week or so. We have a prison project, which is nice. We also work in the Himalayas with healthcare providers at high altitude in these very remote areas where there's no access to healthcare. We provide all kinds of support for Rohingya refugees in Kathmandu. So we're, you know, it's a real integration of UPAYA integrates study, practice, livelihood, social service, and community.
Mm.
It's a real mandala of life that we hope that, you know, has downstream effects. Now we have, you know, many chaplains and institutions all over the world who are bringing the sense of ethics and a Buddhist view and also practice into their role as chaplains. And the same with clinicians.
And what is the website for people to get more information?
Wonderful. It's www.upaya.org.
Yeah, yeah. And let me ask you this. Given the body of work that you've done, the traveling you've done, and the depth I believe you go in many of the other books I've read from you, I'd like to know, I find that as I get older, hopefully I'm learning more. I'm gaining a little more wisdom, even from the mistakes I've made. What is Roshi Joan Halifax learning, and what have you learned about love?
Oh, that's a beautiful question. Well, one of the things I've learned is to love all equally. That it's just a sense of deep care that is not reserved just for your family or your community. But, you know, when I'm in an airport and feeling, you know, actually practicing that, it's an act of practice with people who are total strangers who are hurrying by. So one is to really love all beings equally. Another has to do with understanding how the profound benefits of compassion, the profound benefits of serving others, and that so much of my work as an educator and also practitioner has been to understand what compassion is and how you can teach it in the world, but also you have to live it to the extent that's possible for you at any given moment. And the third thing for me that I think is really very, very visible personally is having been a contemplative practitioner for more than five decades now, it's 55 years, of having the wonderful opportunity to see the fruits of practice become more visible as I've become an elder. You know, I mean, I wanted a quick fix 30 years ago, right? But I didn't realize that, you know, I'd be in my mid-late 70s, and wow, all that stuff I was doing, all those sessions years ago, I see the benefit now.
Yes. You're not slowing down, are you?
Well, I think that, you know, it's not a matter in you know, of velocity. It's a matter of depth. And I feel, you know, my life is deeper and more real, and I feel very grateful to be alive while there's so many problems, because I feel, you know, a thing or two I've learned might be useful to others.
Well said. The book is Standing at the Edge, Finding Freedom, Where Fear and Courage Meet. Roshi Joan Halifax, thank you so much for sharing your time with us, and thank you for the gift of this book.
Thank you so much for, you know, interacting with me, and I've loved making this connection with you.
That was a joy talking to Roshi Joan Halifax. I also want to thank you for joining us as well. We'll have a brand new interview next week.